All right, welcome everyone to our series of ASCO podcasts. We're joined today by Peter O'Donnell from University of Chicago, and we're going to talk about his abstract regarding the KEYNOTE-052 long-term follow-up from the phase 2 study and also work in some of the 361 phase 3. So Peter, thanks for joining us. If you want to maybe briefly introduce yourself and then give us just sort of the high-level summary of data, and then we'll launch into questions.
Sure. As you know, I'm a medical oncologist at the University of Chicago. I see mostly patients with bladder cancer, urothelial cancer, and it was my pleasure to present these data, long-term follow-up data for pembrolizumab in the frontline cisplatin-ineligible population on behalf of my co-authors as well. And, you know, the high-level results here that we're showing, these are now data 5 years after the last patient was enrolled in the trial. The objective response rate, it has not changed from what's been previously published for the overall population. We're seeing just under 30% objective response, but in the high PD-L1 population, it's almost 50%. And I was actually, you know, surprised to remind myself that even in the PD-L1 negative population, it was a 20% objective response rate. And then really the value of the data is looking at the long-term follow-up now that we have, you know, 4 or 5 years of follow-up on many patients. And you see, you know, overall, that the takeaway that I had was that it's 1 out of 5 patients that are still alive 5 years later. And in the high PD-L1 population, it's 1 out of every 3 still alive, which I think is pretty impressive. And we have the duration of response, which is another way to think about these data. You know, if you have a patient who's a responder, they're likely to respond for a very long time. The median duration of response in all comers was almost 3 years in the high PD-L1 population, not yet reached. So, you know, 5 years later here, we're seeing over half of the population still having ongoing responses.
And Peter, the Pembro stopped at 2 years in this study, right? Like other Pembro studies?
Correct.
So it was 24 months of therapy. And obviously then no real drop off after 24 months. Patients responding at 24 months obviously tended to stay in response. Is that fair?
Exactly.
And Peter, any long-term toxicity?
No new toxicity signals long-term. I think we know that, right? I mean, most of the immune checkpoint toxicities tend to happen in the first 6 to 12 months.
And Peter, anything exciting in the biomarker from a TMB or PD-L1 perspective?
We didn't look at that in this data set, so nothing new there.
So I guess one of the other questions would be, you know, how do you look at this in conjunction with the confirmatory data, which didn't show the same, I mean, there wasn't as much activity in the randomized phase 3. Response rates weren't as good. The medians weren't quite as good. The population was probably a better population because, remember, it included the cisplatin eligible as well as the cisplatin ineligible population. So one was a large single arm phase 2 trial. And then the second was, which was published in Lancet Oncology a few weeks ago, the other was the confirmatory 1,000 patient randomized phase 3. Do you think the two data sets are aligned, or do you think actually the randomized phase 3, which wasn't successful, although the monotherapy arm wasn't statistically tested, do you think that actually that we were unable to confirm the findings from your phase 2?
No, I don't think that at all, that we were unable to confirm the findings. So we've talked about this a little bit before, but, you know, the biggest difference between these two data sets, and I'll point out for the audience that the 52 data, the one we're talking about here, is still the largest data set for cisplatin ineligible patients receiving pembrolizumab monotherapy. The biggest difference is the biomarker, right? The PD-L1 positive percentage in the 52 data was under 30%, right? It was 29.7% of the patients were PD-L1 high, whereas in the KEYNOTE-361, I think it was about half the patients. Tom, you can remind me.
Yeah, it was. It was just over half, I think. So it was 50. Let's go with 50%.
So what's going on there, right, is the question for the field, right? Because I think anytime you're selecting, quote unquote, half the patients, you're not really selecting at all.
Peter, and can I ask?
Go ahead.
At the beginning part of 52, there was a biopsy component associated with that where patients had to have a biopsy. And 5 years ago, when we were treating upfront immune therapy, we were probably more nervous and we probably were selected better. And we were at a series of academic institutions, particularly in the US and some in Europe. I wonder if, and I've spoke to yourself and a number of other people
Arjun and Matt and one or two others, Noah, the list goes on. And people tell me that they think they know who we think we can give upfront immune therapy to. They can't put their finger on them and they can't sort of write it down. But they, when they see a patient, you know, maybe relapse, a bit of lymph, relapse after a cystectomy, a year out, maybe lymph node positive, maybe quite young, fit and well, that I'd like to give immune therapy to. Is it possible, actually, that because of the compulsory biopsy at the initial part of the trial, and because we were more cautious around who we were treating, because remember, we had no idea whether immune therapy was going to perform well initially, do you think actually there was a degree of patient which results in the discrepancies in the biomarker positivity, number one, and also some of the discrepancies in the response rates and other bits and pieces?
I think it's a good point you're making, but I don't look at it that way. I'm not sure we were better at selecting the patients back then. I know that a number of the patients that I put on this trial were patients that had really no other option, right? That I was very reluctant to think about even carboplatin-based therapy, and I was giving this to them as, you know, their last chance at any type of therapy. I think we've gotten better over time at selecting those patients, so I would actually argue that we probably weren't as good back then selecting these patients.
Tom, you're saying it was more just the inherent selection of an academic center and requiring a biopsy, not that you were actually selecting them based on clinical features?
I mean, my mindset in the randomized phase three is everyone goes in because that's what we were doing. And I was enrolling everyone into the 361. I think our site, you know, we enroll a number of patients. Whereas I think in the frontline trials, when we started with those single arm phase two trials, I wonder if, you know, those patients with clearly aggressive disease, I was, because remember our response rate second line for Atezo was 13%. And we didn't yet have the results of 210 or we didn't have the results of 52. And so we didn't really know. And because right. chemotherapy has a higher response rate, maybe saying, I'm a bit nervous about 13. I accept that Pembro and unselected patients were 21%. And we knew by then the biomarker wasn't really working that well. You remember we enrolled all comers, not just the biomarker positives to these trials. Right. And actually, in the Pembro trial, it looks like the biomarker hasn't helped at all. In the Atezo trial, I think there's debate going on around that.
Right, right.
And so I just wonder if we were saying, this patient goes in and this patient gets chemotherapy and they can go on a second-line immune therapy study at the time. I don't know. Because deep down, I feel there are some differences between the data sets in terms of the response rate and how patients perform.
There's clear differences. I guess the question is, you know, Peter, are there objective differences in patient characteristics or other features that you can say, well, this is why the data sets look different, or no?
Why would the prevalence of the biomarker go up? It doesn't mesh with any of the other data sets that we have, which all say that about a third of patients with your metastatic advanced urothelial cancer are PD-L1 high by any metric or any of the assays. The 50% is an outlier.
So there is an explanation for that, and that might be that because a lot of the patients at the beginning of the trial had a compulsory biopsy, and in 361 it was always historical tissue, that actually could account for that discrepancy, and it may be that real-time biopsies have a lower positivity rate. I mean, that's a possible explanation, but there was a difference in terms of collection of tissue, it's important to say that not all patients were forced to have a biopsy. There was an early amendment in the trial, and I'm not suggesting for a second that this is an unselected patient. This is a selected population of patients, but there do seem to be discrepancies in 52 and 36. And one of the broader questions is there an easy explanation? Peter, I have to agree with what you've said. I don't think the biopsy issue actually covers that net. The biomarker issue, maybe a little bit, but not completely. Does it explain why the response rates were less impressive in the randomized phase three? Well, we've seen that before. One of the things I think that was really important, and I don't think we're talking about.
Was it that difference though, Tom? I mean, do you really think that the immune monotherapy arm in 361 is that different from 52?
Well,
formally evaluated, but the duration of response, the percentage of patients responding.
So the duration of response will always. So the duration of response, I think, will always be the same. But you're quoting response rates above 50% in some subsets, and we didn't get.
No, I didn't. I said high 40s for the PD-L1
47. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so that's high. We didn't get near that, obviously, in our study.
I feel like this is a Yermigos debate, not an ASCO podcast, but go ahead. I guess the question is, Peter, for those, we've had this debate before, of which patients would you select for pembro monotherapy? I mean, so I guess putting the debate aside, focusing on the biomarker, are you using the biomarker to select at all, or is it more that clinical indolent, nodal-only disease, et cetera, whatever other features you use? What is the role of the biomarker?
I'm using both. I mean, we're required to use the biomarker right now, right, by the label. We're
Fair.
Still required
yeah.
to use the biomarker. So, yes, I send it, but I'm selecting the patient before I even get the biomarker
yeah.
result back, right?
That's
your
question.
Point, I think,
yeah.
right? So it's got to be a patient that's not a rapid progressor, right? A patient that doesn't have liver metastases, a patient that's not in terrible pain that I want, I know that I can wait weeks to get the pembrolizumab working.
What was the median time to response in the study? Sorry, Tom, what was the, because we're kind of talking about, delayed response
said, but,
and indolent disease.
I believe it was at the first scan. So just,
okay.
Around the 2 month mark.
Okay.
Yeah, so the response rate in 361 float around the sort of 30% level, right. and in the biomarker positive population is the same. I think the thing that was surprising for me and the thing that I wanted to talk about was the carboplatin group did well in 361. So those patients treated with carboplatin, their response rate was higher than we expected. Their outcomes was obviously impressive, and we've looked at that subset data at ASCO GU this year, and
we actually know that a number of those patients were technically cisplatin eligible but got carboplatin by the investigator choice, correct?
So
the investigator changed them to carboplatin.
Yeah.
But that, I think that was more marked in 130. I think in 361 it was probably more balanced. I think because it was about a 50-50 split. But the difference, I think, from my perspective, I think is that in Maria DeSantis' EORTC study, and the reason why this was an area of unmet need, is her overall survival in that big trial was only about 9 months, the carboplatin patients. But in the other trials in 130 and in 361, we've seen those carbon patients come in very similar to Genesis.
A number of the DeSantis patients had two poor prognostic factors, if I recall.
So it's possible, Peter, that we've been somewhat, I think we, with hindsight, we were probably a bit naive to think that carboplatin was so ineffective, and that patients could get six cycles of carboplatin and their median survival would be between 6 and 9 months. And I think the field's moved on. I think we've got better at giving chemotherapy. And I think those patients have done better. And I think that's why.
Do you think carboplatin still has the durability? Because I don't see that. I don't see the CRs. I don't see the durable response.
Well, the CR, this is difficult. So the CR rate in the biomarker positive population with gem carbo, which was presented at GU-ASCO, was 18%. So the CR rate for gem carbo is higher than the for pembrolizumab in 361. And we haven't talked much about that. And the reason why I don't talk about it intentionally is I don't think CR correlates with cure. The data from the avalumab trial, so the median duration of CR is only 4 months. So at the time of completion of chemotherapy, if you had a CR with metastatic urothelial cancer, duration of CR is only 4 months. So I'm
yeah.
not sure, but
I can tell you that's
is
different in the 52 here, right? CR clearly correlates with cure in the 52 data. Those patients almost never recur.
So I think in broad terms, these radiological tools that we use have got some significant flaws with them, and I agree the quality of the responses are better, and that indeed is why the Kaplan-Meier curves ultimately cross in 361. Immune therapy catches up, we lose some patients along the way, and the biomarker doesn't currently select the winners.
So I've got one more question, Peter, that looking at your duration of response in this table of PD-L1 negative, it was 27%, PD-L1 positive almost 60%, who are duration of response greater than 4 years, 48 months. Do you think those patients are cured? I mean, they've now been 2 years off. They've not been 2 years off pembro, right? If they're at 48 months, at least.
Correct.
More than
I do. I think certainly, and certainly the PD-L1 high patients, they appear to be cured. They appear to be never recurring.
Yeah.
I guess one of the questions would be, can we cure the same group of patients with maintenance of avelumab? And the answer is, I think you probably can. Can we
can that net by giving capture more patients that potentially results in long-term durable remission? I think the answer is probably yes. And so although obviously I'm involved in 361 and a number of other trials and I have a number of I'm still very nervous, and this 52 durable data hasn't swayed my opinion that I think treating unselected patients, biomarker positive patients, with 361 as the preferred option is not the right answer, and that we still should be. Although I do accept Peter's, and we debated this previously, and I don't think this has changed, I do accept Peter's perspective that there are some patients in some institutions who potentially can pick the winners.
Right.
I want to respond. I'm holding myself back.
I was going to ask you for your sort of summary, like these new data. I mean, durability is clearly key here, a fraction of cure. We've debated patient selection, which we're not necessarily going to agree upon. But what's sort of the take home point from the abstract? Let's just do that for the listeners.
Yeah, I'll say, you know, in the population right now that meets the label indication, the FDA label indication, there's one out of three of those patients that are still alive 5 years later with immunomonotherapy, right? And so to me, that's a big case for retaining the current option of immunotherapy as a treatment for this cisplatin-ineligible population up front, because there are clearly patients, and if we could debate who those are, but clearly patients that they will never need anything else but immunotherapy in their life.
Yeah. Tom, you have a final question, or you want to respond since we've turned this into a debate?
I like the fact we've had to. It's the first time we've managed to debate into two. I hope the listeners are okay with that. And I realize that we have sort of talked about this before. From my perspective, I think the ODAT meetings and I think Peter have been really helpful. I don't think my position's changed that much. I still think chemotherapy and maintenance avelumab is currently the safer in unselected patients.
Tom, you remember that, you know, the maintenance avelumab data are totally a biased data set. They took away all the worst patients.
So it's not biased in as much as the trial was randomized in a one-to-one. So there's not a the trial wasn't biased.
All the patients that didn't have stable disease aren't even included in the randomization.
So the stable disease and the response patients are included. But Peter, I think this is a really important point, and I'm pleased we could disagree on this as well. listen, Peter. So you got Mrs. Lim. I had a patient came in 2 weeks ago.
Oh boy, here we go.
No, it's important. It's important because I'm going to start presenting this patient a lot more. Because I tend to present winners in my A series, and I don't know why I do that. I've had a bit of a inward look. I suspect I'm not going to get invited to many meetings, but I think we sometimes forget those patients we leave behind. And in bladder cancer, about 20% of patients have progression of disease. And so this lady who I saw, I gave two cycles of chemo to. She was admitted to the ward. She got liver metastasis, and she got, but not a huge number, one or two, and she got some lung metastasis. She was admitted to the ward. I went to see her. I assumed she had neutropenic sepsis, and actually she got progression of disease in the liver. And she has primary progression, urothelial cancer. We reviewed the biology, we looked at the scans, and there was nothing wrong with it. It's just the chemotherapy wasn't working. And, you know, obviously we said to her, what are we going to do? And we tried to get out of hospital. We got her out. She wanted some immune therapy. We gave her a cycle of immune therapy. It didn't work. She progressed. Not with us anymore. And I'm afraid my experience is those patients that have primary progression of disease, immune therapy doesn't rescue those patients. Patients who progress on chemotherapy with urothelial cancer are not rescued by immune therapy. They're not rescued by the combination of immune therapy plus atezolizumab or pembrolizumab, clearly in that trial. So when you say it's a biased data set, number one, I don't think it's biased. I think it's a randomized trial and it's balanced. It is a selected population, and the benefit of the trials, we haven't included those patients, but those patients don't win with anything. And certainly,
But what you and others are doing is taking the avelumab data and comparing that against immunomonotherapy. That comparison's never been done. I'm saying there's limitations to both data sets, and so you're making that comparison, even though I think it's not fair.
So Peter, I don't disagree with aspects of that. What I think you can do is one to pick an approach. And there are two approaches. Either one gives upfront immune therapy, or alternatively, one gives chemotherapy followed by maintenance avelumab. And unfortunately, when patients sit in my, as they are in yours, they say, what are the options, doctor? And those are the two. And therefore, one does have to make some comparisons, either direct or indirect, to those data sets. You can't say, we'll start chemotherapy and hope for the best, and then we may or may not give you maintenance avelumab. You say, we'll give you chemotherapy. If it doesn't work, it's going to be really tough. If it does work, we'll give you it. And then...
I mean, I think just to wrap up before we get into an hour-long debate, we would agree there are select patients clearly who can benefit long-term from immune therapy that we don't really know how to select, and the biomarker's inconsistent. There are probably some clinical features, but that different docs like you guys with experience might apply that selection criteria more or less strictly. I mean, Peter's probably a little more likely to select patients and you're much less likely, but it's not wrong. It's ends of a spectrum. Is that fair?
We agree on that. I bet Tom would agree more if we were talking about the INVIGOR 130 data set, where he believes more.
So the INVIGOR 130 data, and I wasn't involved in that trial, I have to say, and I don't, you know, Peter, and we've got some data coming out in the not too distant future in different areas. This biomarker issue, where that hazard ratio and that Kaplan-Meier curve and the biomarker positive looks a bit more encouraging. And I realize it's exploratory, as is the case with 361. And that's another shortcoming of the study, is that, you know, the randomized data is exploratory and not positive. So it makes it very speculative currently for both trials. And I guess when you look at that and say it's exploratory and not positive, and there's a different trial which looks kind of stronger, that a stronger data set, that's where I begin to get into problems, even with the atezolizumab data. Remember, the randomized phase 3 durvalumab trial with durva-tremi in the biomarker positives came in with a hazard ratio of 0.74. And remember, we picked the ITT population and the biomarker positive population. That's had we picked the biomarker positive population for durva-tremi, we would have had a positive randomized phase 3 study with upfront immune combination therapy. Durvalumab is added, or tremelimumab adds about 10% response rate to durvalumab, 10% on top, which then pushes it above or pushes it in parallel with chemotherapy. And that's the most robust data set here. They're all exploratory. None of them are statistically significant. That one at least seems to beat chemotherapy, where the other two seem to struggle at the moment.
All right, Ty, we got to wrap this up. I have to get to clinic. Peterman, give you the last word.
No, I appreciate, you know, the chance to share these long-term data.
Tom can talk forever.
I apologize.
My conclusion is that I think it validates the FDA label indication in the United States that this is an option for some patients.
It's a very fair summary. Agreed. Can we move on? Peter, it's nice to chat.
Mike, likewise to both of you.
Thanks for joining. Enjoyed the debate.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.